So the next mitzvah in our account of mitzvahs. So we actually we've finished everything we wanted to discuss in the book of Yikra. Now we're moving on to the Midbar. This is mitzvah in the count of the Sefer Chochmah, mitzvah number 365 out of 613. So we're over halfway now. We didn't do them all until now. We skipped around a little bit, but we did a lot of them. And this mitzvah is the procedure of how to take care of a sota. A sota is a woman who is suspected of marital infidelity, of adulterous behavior. There's no proof for it. We'll discuss how this procedure works. And there's a whole procedure as to how the process she goes through, how we are able to confirm the reports that she did something wrong. And again, even though a lot of these things seem to be distant and obscure in terms of, you know, what we participated in modern days, there's always a lot of lessons and meaning behind all these mitzvahs. So we'll take it slowly. I'll try first to go through the idea of what is a sota and what's the process, and then we'll discuss some of the meaning behind these procedures. So first and foremost, this is all quoted in Parshas Naso in the book of Midbar. The word sota itself in Hebrew, samech vav tes hey, sota. So it refers to this, you know, deviant or suspected wife who is accused of adultery. The word itself could come from one of two roots, it seems. Either from the idea of satiya, which means to veer off the proper path, that she's a woman who's kind of deviated from what's proper and moral. The other idea is that the word sota could also be related to the word shota, which is something someone who's a fool, foolish. The sin and the shin are all the same letters. You know, we move the dot left to right. And the idea of a shota is a foolish behavior, and that this woman who has defied her commitment to her husband has done very foolish behavior. Something without thought, which doesn't, you know, which in the long run would not make sense for her, is a tremendous violation of the Torah, and ruins lives. The rabbis learn from this idea that a sota is related to shota. The sota is somebody who does a foolish behavior. But the truth is that any time we defy the Torah, we're acting foolishly. It says, "Einan amchote, person does not sin, unless that it has entered into them a ruach shtus, a spirit of foolishness." And any time we defy the Torah, we look at it as a spirit of foolishness, because intellectually it doesn't make sense to defy God. I mean, there's assuming that there's a God and there's a Torah, to defy that is totally irrational. So we look at any time any of us ever do something which is against the Torah, it is an act of foolishness, and it must be because some foolish spirit has entered into our actions.
Despite the fact that spelling is totally different, right? It's a samach.
Well, the Torah uses a sin. The Torah uses a sin. Yeah.
Right, but the
Sota. Oh, fine. But so the Torah itself uses the word sin. So that's the Shota and Sota. Right. With a sin. Ish ki sista, ish shows the sin. Yeah. I don't know why it changes, you know, in the Gemara spelling to the Samach, but maybe so you don't confuse it with the Shota. So that's the word Sota means. The Torah describes it, when it first describes her actions, it says, she kisista ishto, the woman has either, as we said, acted foolishly or veered off the path, u'ma'alo bo ma'al. And she has, the word ma'al bo ma'al in Hebrew is hard to translate. You would say it's some sort of treachery that she's done towards her husband, some sort of defiance, treachery, breach of trust. But that same term is used in another context. There's a context in halacha called me'ila, which means if I have something which is dedicated to the temple, something sacred, I have a sacrifice, which I didn't yet bring, but I've designated to become a sacrifice. So I have my cow, and I say this cow is going to be an offering for Hashem on the altar. So that cow is now considered sacred, it's hekdesh. And if I then use that cow for my own purposes, we call that me'ilah. That's a violation of the Torah. I'm not allowed to use it for my own purposes now. I can't now take that cow and chop it up as a steak. You know, I have to make sure I bring it as a sacrifice. So the same term is used when you violate sacred property, it's called me'ila. And when a woman is accused of adultery, it's called me'ila. So commentaries point out that because we look at marriage as also a sacred bond, and a violation of that sacred bond is really equivalent to violating sacred property, the same concept. So this woman who has made a sacred commitment to her husband, who has now, you know, been treacherous, she's defied her husband, and she's gone with another man. So that is comparable to taking a sacred item and dedicated to God and using it for your own purposes. So that's why the same term of ma'alo ba ma'al, this term of ne'ilo is used. It's speaking to the sanctity of marriage, the sacred relationship which is there. So what's the technical process of this? You know, what is this woman? Now, we're not talking about a woman who we have proof that she's committed adultery. If there is testimony of two witnesses, the woman's committed adultery, that's not relevant to this discussion. This is where we don't have proof. If there's proof of adultery, and the woman was warned, and did it on purpose, and there's two witnesses testifying to the fact she's adulteress, so she's actually liable to capital, so the man and woman are liable to capital punishment in that case, according to Torah law. It's a very severe crime. The case that we're dealing with today is where we have no testimony that there was an adulterous relationship. What are the suspicions? It's ground for suspicions. What are the suspicions? So the way it works is that, let's say a man, he suspects his wife of some inappropriate behavior. So the first thing he does, we refer to Hebrew as kinu, he has to warn her. And he says that, I don't want you to seclude yourself with that man. Right? There's a particular man that the husband suspects of doing something inappropriate with his wife, and he warns his wife, you may not have, in front of two witnesses, I'm warning you that you may not seclude yourself with this man. So there's some grounds now for suspicion. And if she then goes ahead and secludes herself with that same man that she was warned about, and we have testimony that they were secluded with one another, we don't know what happened inside those closed doors, but they're secluded with one another. So now she has the status of a sota, meaning that we've got a suspicion that there was some foul play over here, but yet we have no absolute proof. All we know is that they were, after being warned, she was secluded with this man once again. So at that point, she becomes forbidden to her husband until she goes through this process. The two of them cannot resume marital relationships until they go through the process. What's the process? So the process would be that they go to the local based in the local court, and these witnesses testify to what happened. You know, she was warned, and she did it again, and you know that. So they declare her a sota. So at that point, they have to send her off to Jerusalem, to the Sanhedrin, to the high court. The sota process takes place in the high court in Jerusalem. It cannot take place in any local or regional courts around Israel. It has to be the high court, the Sanhedrin, and they take care of the sota process. So they travel from where they live. They travel to Jerusalem, to the Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin was located on the Temple Mount. You know, they had their chamber right there next to the temple. So they go to the Temple Mount. Now when they get there, the judges at first try to scare her, to show her how terrible it will be if she's actually... She's still claiming that she's innocent, right? The judges try to scare her and show her, well, if you're lying, you're really guilty, you go through this process, it's going to be a terrible thing. And then what they say to her, they give her a little speech. So I'll quote for you the speech they give her. This is, I'm quoting from the way the Rambam cites the speech, but it's really originates itself in the Talmud. But the Rambam, Maimonides, says she gets to Jerusalem, and first thing they tell her is, they don't want her to go through the process, because if she goes through the process, the results are terrible if she's actually guilty. So it says, they tell her, Biti, my daughter, wine can make us do a lot of foolish things. I mean, maybe you did this, you know, you did this act because you drank too much. Harbis chokosa, you know, being lightheaded, being a little bit too loose can cause a lot of immoral acts. Harbu yodus asa, you know, being too childish can cause these acts. Bad neighbors, you know, bad influences, peer pressure can cause a lot of terrible acts. So they tell her, we know there could be a lot of excuses as to why you participated in such a terrible act. And we recognize that. However, Al tigrami l'shem ha'gadol, do not cause God's great name, which is written in sanctity, to have to be erased. Because the way the process works, we'll talk about later, they're going to take God's name and erase God's name in water. So if they go ahead with this process, they're going to take God's name and actually erase it, which is typically prohibited in the Torah. You can't erase God's name. But this is the one time where we go ahead and we erase God's name. And they tell her, many, many people before you have been involved in such acts of nishtafu, and they've been, you know, washed away. And then they say, there have been great people who have been challenged by lust and passion and made mistakes. And we even tell her stories from the Tanakh. You know, we have the story in Parshas Vayishlach about Yehuda and Tamar. We have a story about King David, Davinelch and Bathsheba. A lot of stories of great people who did have challenges in the realm of lust and passion. And we tell her these stories. And we say they admitted to their flaws. There's a story about Reuven, a story about Amnon. So they try to make it easy for her to confess. They want her to confess. Now, if she confesses, then she's divorced from her husband without a kesuba. So she doesn't get the benefit of the payments of the kesuba, and she has to get a divorce. But that's what happens if she confesses. But yeah, if she confesses, she doesn't have to go through the terrible, embarrassing, and painful process of being a sota. So that's the first thing that happens. So after they give her that speech, if she still didn't confess, so the next thing they do is that they they walk her around the temple, and they bring her around different places to make her feel a little bit, you know, more at ease to confess, or try to encourage confession. But if she's still staying strong, either she really is innocent, or she's pleading innocent, but she still pleads innocent at this point, they bring her to the eastern gate of the temple. At that point, they dress her in some unbecoming clothing. Anything, she's wearing nice clothing, they take off and give her different clothing, which is not so attractive. They remove all her jewelry. And all the women in the area have to come watch this process, because they want all women to realize how important it is to maintain a moral relationship with your husband. The men are allowed to come watch, but the women around have to come watch what's happening. They make her take an oath. And the oath is that, you know, if you're innocent, you're going to end up, you'll be safe, and you'll be blessed. But if you're guilty, whether it be from this man who we suspect, or from some other man that we don't know about, right? But if you're guilty, so you're going to drink the special waters of the sota, and if you're guilty, you're going to die a gruesome death. It says, the wording is, yarech nofelas, your thigh is going to fall, and your stomach's going to swell. I'm not clear exactly what happens. Some sort of like, you know, bottle, you know, the body kind of like, you know, bloats out, and she dies in that manner. That's how it seems to be described. But then they make her take an oath. And the oath isn't just about the man that we suspect. This oath is about any, if she ever had any adult relationship during her marriage, even if it's another man we don't know about, she's never caught with that other man, it would still, these waters will still test her on that as well. So now they take a parchment, and on this parchment is written the passage of the Torah which discusses the idea of sota. In that passage is God's name as well, you know, God's holy name. They take a clay vessel, and they put water into the clay vessel from the kiur. The kiur was like the special water urn they had in the Beis HaMikdash. So they took water from the kiur and put it into the clay vessel. They then took some dust from the Beis HaMikdash, from under a tile in the building. They took some dust off the floor and tossed in the water. They added in a bitter ingredient to make it taste bitter. It's not clear exactly what the ingredient was, but some sort of bitter herb, bitter ingredient to make the water taste bitter. And they dropped in the parchment until the writing, you know, dissolved into the water. So now we have this concoction of water and dust and ink and this bitter ingredient, which is supposed to now test her. If she, and at this point, the name of God is erased. This is the point where they erase the name of God. Until this point, she can confess. And if she doesn't want to drink the waters, she can say, I'm not confessing, but I'm refusing to drink, and I'll get divorced instead. She has that option. But once they erase God's name, that's it. Once God's name is erased, they force her to drink. And they'll physically force her to drink.
I think I said there was capital punishment involved. If she confesses, isn't she going to get capital punishment?
Well, you can't get capital punishment without, you know, if there aren't witnesses. If you confess, you don't get punished in court.
Okay. What happens?
So she's forced to get divorced and loses her ksuba. That's it. And she goes on with her life, you know. With a bad reputation, but she goes on with her life, you know. In a Jewish court, they'll never punish you when you confess. For monetary law, they will. If you confess to a debt, they'll make you pay the debt. But in terms of giving you capital punishment or giving you lashes or anything of the like, then if you confess, they won't give that to you. So the confession now will just force her to get divorced and lose her ksuba. That's all. That's what the confession will do. But she can also say, I'm maintaining my plea that I'm innocent, but I refuse to drink. And then they won't make her drink. They'll just tell her, okay, so you have to get divorced then. Those are her options. But if they raise, once they raise God's name, then she must drink it. I mean, if she can confess that she's guilty, then they'll let her off. But if she still maintains her innocent plea, she can't get out of drinking anymore. So she pleads innocent, then even though she doesn't want to drink, once they raise God's name, she has to drink. So they take her now, and they tear her clothing. They uncover and they mess up her hair. They tie a rope around her chest. They try to make her look, you know, very unbecoming, very disheveled. And they're trying to embarrass her. And everyone's watching this. This is an extremely embarrassing ritual. The husband, who's accusing her of adultery, has to bring an offering to the temple. He brings a barley offering. First, he carries the barley offering in a wicker basket, in a very simple wicker basket. Usually, you bring an offering, you bring in like a fancy, you know, gold, silver, and a nice vessel. But he brings it in a very simple wicker basket. They put this offering on her hands. Then they take the barley and put it into the fancy vessel that the Beis Hamikdash uses for offerings.
Most offerings are not barley either. They're barley.
Right, usually it's wheat. Yeah, barley is considered a very lowly. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. Barley is considered a very lowly offering. It's forbidden to put oil into this offering. Most grain flour offerings had oil mixed in and also had lavona, some sort of, I think, frankincense they translated and mixed in. It's like an aromatic spice. For this offering, for the sota, it was just plain barley, nothing else. So this offering was brought at the time. They then forced her to drink the water. So if she's innocent, then nothing will happen to her. And not only that, because of all the shame and embarrassment she had to endure, she gets special blessing from God. The Talmud tells us that she never had children. She'll then conceive and bear children. If she used to have children with a lot of pain, her birth will be very easy for her. She'll be strong. She'll be fruitful. They describe that her face will shine. I guess she'll become more beautiful. She'll be a very healthy, vibrant woman, despite her condition at that point. And she'll give birth to healthy, she'll be fruitful, healthy children, etc. So she'll be blessed. I mean, she had to endure a lot. And it was all big issue. I mean, the truth is, she brought this upon herself in that she secluded herself with this man after being warned. On the other hand, seclusion with a man would not warrant all this embarrassment. So because she went through all this embarrassment, God gives her this special blessing that since you went through it all and you're still innocent, you'll be blessed. However, if she's guilty, so then she goes through this gruesome death where her body swells up and, as if she's beginning to burst. I don't know exactly what happens at that point. But then they remove her. Once they see her starting to swell, they'll remove her from the temple area because they don't want her to defile the temple in any way. So they remove her, they take her out. At that same exact moment, if she's guilty and she's suffering through this death, the man with which she had the relationship will also suffer that same exact death. He can be anywhere in the world at the time. It could be he's long gone, this man. But if she's guilty, then he's going to die at that same exact moment as she dies. Because he's just, obviously, just as guilty as she is. So he could be somewhere off in China doing business, and when she drinks this water and she swells up and dies, he'll do the same thing wherever he's standing, this man. The Talmud tells us that if the woman has a special merit of Torah study, then that will delay her death. Even if she's guilty, and she will die, but it won't be immediate on the spot. It might be a couple of years until she suffers this death. So she'll buy a little more time. She has special merits. But not for that, she would die on the spot of drinking these waters. So these waters then will verify for us, did she actually commit this adulterous relationship or not? And that's what we're trying to do here. So that's the process. Very interesting process. Have I got the process clear? Any question about the process? Okay, got the process clear. So,
The local based in only has to verify that she was secluded with the forbidden man, with the proscribed man.
Right.
That she had been warned and was secluded.
Correct. Then they actually send an escort with her to Yerushalayim. At that point, they're done with their job. It's up to Sanhedrin to take care of the rest of the procedure.
And the confession that you're talking about, the Sanhedrin, she's confessing that she had relations with some man other than her husband.
Right, correct. Right. It's not the seclusion. That we've already proven. It's the reverse. Right. Correct. Okay, so let's understand this process. I mean, it's an interesting process. It's, it seems to be quite an embarrassing, quite a very, very powerful procedure. So what's the idea? So the simple understanding is just that it encourages marital fidelity. And we understand the sanctity of a marriage, the commitment made between husband and wife. And for a woman to defy that, it's immoral, it's unethical, it's something which is totally against the grain of how we understand Jewish marriage. So that's the simple understanding. So that's why adultery is a capital offense according to our law. And that's why a woman who's accused has to go through such a process. We really want to verify. And also going to discourage others from ever being involved in any sort of suspicious behavior. So this is really discourage any people from being involved in such behavior because it's such a terribly embarrassing process. No one ever want to suffer through it. So even though in that seclusion it could be that there was no foul play per se, maybe there was playing Monopoly together. But we don't want to have any semblance of adultery in any way. So we have, if you're secluded in this manner, you have to go through this terribly embarrassing process. Ramban, Nachmanides, he says a very interesting point. Number one, he says that the goal here also is to avoid producing mamzerim, illegitimate children, Because the stigma of a mamzer in Jewish law is a very difficult stigma to have, because they can't marry into regular Jewish lineage. He says it also differentiates between us and the other nations. Now, I think nowadays, I hope it seems that marriage also carries weight amongst non-Jews as well. But if you read back historically, think of Roman society or Greek society, I don't think the marriage bond meant all that much. And it seems like there was a lot of very loose relationships amongst the Gentile world. And in contrast to that, not only did we say it's forbidden, but we had such a terribly embarrassing and severe punishment and process for any sort of marital immorality. So that's another point that Nachmanides says. The Abarbanel, another famous commentator, he says that this whole process, it gives a method for the husband to address his suspicions. Meaning that nobody wants to live in a marriage they suspect one another. That's not going to be a very pleasant marriage. We'll not promote shalom bayis, peace in the household. It's not going to be a very pleasant existence. So if the man has suspicions, there is a process at least that he can verify those suspicions. At the end, then she's probably not happy with him. There definitely was some sort of a discord in this marriage. That's clear. I mean, she was secluded with another man, and he accused her of this and that. But overall, at the end, at least it's clear what did happen and what did not happen. And it gives somebody the way to move past suspicions. Because if the man suspected his wife and never had a way to verify it, he might be concerned his kids are mamzerim. Because he has maybe some other man followed his kids. I don't know. I don't trust my wife anymore. So at least this will verify the wife's behavior and verify the children. That's what it will do. The Sefer HaChinuch writes that not only will this prevent infidelity, but it will then encourage stronger marriages. Because once people get into their heads that it's all about my husband, all about my wife, they're not going to start even entertaining ideas of others to have relationships with. Because, okay, I know that's out of the question, 100%. I'm not willing to go through any of these terrible punishments, this embarrassment. So you're going to focus on improving your own personal marriage and adding into your own marriage love and peace and sanctity rather than having this notion of looking for others. So this process encourages stronger marriage bonds in general. Now, Nachmanides makes another fascinating point. He says that this mitzvah in the Torah, to go through this process, it actually depends upon counting. You count upon a miracle. Because you're counting upon that this concoction you're going to make for her to drink will actually kill her. And typically drinking water and dust and some bitter herbs and a little ink is not going to kill you. But this process actually depends upon a miracle. And Nachmanides says that it's the only mitzvah in the Torah that you find that depends upon a miracle. We can actually create a miracle. That's what we can. If we follow what the Torah says, a miracle will happen, assuming she's guilty. It's miraculous that she dies based on this mixture. So we're invoking God's miracle in order to verify the behavior of this woman.
To have her die.
That
sounds so contrary to God.
Maybe the miracle is that she drinks the stuff which would normally cause somebody to die, and she doesn't die if she's innocent.
No, but
I don't know.
If it
usually won't cause you to die. I mean, physically, it's not a lethal mixture. It's not poisonous.
No, we're
I don't think it'd be tasty, but it'd be poisonous.
Yeah. I never heard of a miracle that would be somebody when individual dies. We hear of miracles for a nation to be saved, but not, or one individual, but not saved.
That's a good point. You're using the term hoping for miracles. Like miracles that we hope for as salvations. But miracles just mean supernatural events and processes. The 10 plagues were miracles, and they killed a lot of people. It's the same kind. The splitting of the sea was a miracle also. But it's a way that we can invoke a supernatural reaction, something which is a very natural. She takes a natural drink of something which is not poisonous, and it's going to bring out a supernatural response. So, and the Ramban actually calls it a kindness of God. As you're addressing Judy, that seems to be very kind, but he says it's a kindness of God. Why? Because through this, God shows the sanctity of his own nation. Because his appropriate marriage relationships actually allow for God's presence to rest upon the Jewish people. If we maintain our sanctity, we maintain our focus in our sacred relationships that we have, that allows God to rest amongst us. And which is why the Mishnah tells us that when the Jewish people themselves became more immoral and more involved in immoral behavior, this process, they stopped using this process. It says in the Mishnah, Maseches Sota says, Mishrabu and Menachem, once the adulterers became plentiful, the waters of Sota were discontinued. And the Ramban says the reason for this is because we didn't deserve the miracle anymore. That until this point, you know, when 99.9% of Jews were acting very sacred and moral, and you had that small, tiny percentage that were doing things inappropriate, so God gave us this special way to verify, to weed out the people who are misbehaving, and to maintain our sanctity. Once the illicit behavior became more widespread, so at that point, they discontinued this process because we didn't deserve the miracles. So that's the what Nachmanides describes, Ramban. But it's a fascinating thing to think about because it really speaks to the importance of the sanctity of marriage. That sanctity of marriage is something which promotes the sanctity of the Jewish people. And when those relationships are kept sacred, God can dwell amongst his people because God only dwells in areas where he finds sanctity. If people are acting immorally, so then God removes his own presence from amongst the people. That's the importance of this process. So it's the one place in the Torah that we actually have a mitzvah to invoke a miracle. And it really speaks to the power of the sanctity of a Jewish marriage. And beyond that, God says, not only will I bring a miracle about, I'll let you erase my name for this process. I mean, typically it's prohibited to erase God's name. It's a Torah violation to erase God's name. However, the process of Sota requires you to erase God's name. You drop the parchment into the water and it dissolves. You're erasing God's name. And the idea is because a marriage which ends in immoral behavior drives away God from this world. That's what it does. You know, illicit relationships, immoral behavior, drive away God from this world. There's a famous idea which many of you may have heard before. The Gemara says that the term for man and woman in Hebrew, Ish and Isha, each have three letters. Two of the letters, you know, in both words are the same. You have Aleph and Shin, Ish, Aleph and Shin, Isha, Aleph and Shin. But in the word for man, Ish, has a Yod. The word for woman has a Hey. The Yod and Hey come together, that creates God's name. Yod and Hey are God's name. Because the bond between man and woman creates sanctity. A moral, sacred bond between man and woman creates sanctity and brings God down to this world. But when that relationship is broken, that breaks up God's name. The man goes on his own, woman goes on her own. The Yod separates, the Hey separates, and it drives away God from this world. So you have the same exact concept physically performed in the process of Sota. You take God's name and you erase it. Because we're showing her, if you actually committed this adulterous act, you've driven away God from this world. God's name has been erased because of you. Immoral behavior destroys the sanctity, the presence of God in this world. So the idea of Sota promotes the sacred bond of marriage, and a woman who's guilty of adultery has driven away God from this world. Now I want to discuss a few of the symbolism, a few of the details of this process. We talked about how the offering which is brought during this process to the temple is a barley offering. You say that the husband, he brings a barley offering during this process. So I think we mentioned a few weeks ago that barley was always considered animal food. In classic Jewish thought, even in modern days, I mean, wheat is really the staple of human life, you know, wheat bread. And barley, historically, was always considered animal fodder. That's what barley was. So it's very rare you find a barley offering in the temple. But one time you find it, it's offering brought because of a sota. So one point made is that we bring barley because she acted based on animalistic urges, not based on her sacred charge as a wife, as a Jewish wife. Because she acted animalistically, the offering brought on her behalf is animal food. It's further pointed out, the Hebrew word for barley is sa'ora, and it relates to the word sa'ara, which is, you know, anger, turbulence. Ruach sa'ara is a turbulent wind. And it represents God's wrath towards those people who act immorally. So the idea of offering of sa'ora is because the behavior exhibited evokes sa'ara, evokes anger and turbulence from God. The Torah prohibits putting oil into this offering. And again, simply, you know, when you add in oil, it usually kind of makes it a nicer, more pleasant food. It improves the quality of the food. But the Sefer HaChinuch writes that oil, and others write as well, oil is something which brings light. The oil is what you use to fuel your candle, to bring light to the world. And the act that she did was an act of darkness. She acted probably, you know, likely in darkness, you know, under the shadows of the night, you know, performing immoral behavior. And she did an act of darkness, and darkness drives away any sort of light and goodness from this world. We always use oil. We've spoken about this before. Oil is something which is commonly used in Jewish thought. Oil we used to anoint our kings. We anointed the Kohanim. We anoint with oil. Mashiach is the anointed one. He's anointed. Because oil represents greatness. It represents a certain spiritual standing, a spiritual greatness. And she acted in a very lowly way, so therefore her offering doesn't get oil. The Sefer Chinuch points out that oil has the property that it always rises to the top. You mix oil and water, the oil rises to the top. And that's why it represents, you know, something high and lofty, you know, lofty behavior. That's why, you know, we light the menorah in the temple. It represents something very spiritual. And her behavior was something which was not high, wasn't elevated. It was a very lowly behavior. So therefore, there's no oil in her offering because she sunk to the bottom as well. Her acts are coming from the bottom, from the depths. There's also no lavona, no frankincense in the offering. Typically, a flower offering has this spice, the frankincense within it. I think that's the translation, frankincense. And her offering can't have it. It's the same idea. Her offering has to be something very plain, very simple, very boring, because we're not dressing it up anyway. It's not a beautiful offering to show our thanks to God. It's an offering trying to portray her immoral behavior. The water that she drinks, we said it has water. The water was taken from the kior. The kior was the big water vessel that stood in the temple courtyard. And the kior was made out of copper. It was actually a very famous copper it was made out of, because it was made out of the copper that, who donated this copper? The women who, like, in the desert, donated their copper mirrors to build the kior. And it's discussed that what was the significance of the copper mirrors? Because when the Jews were slaves in Egypt, so Pharaoh had the men sleep out in the fields, and didn't, because he wanted to separate them from their wives and let them produce any more Jewish children. So the wives would beautify themselves in their mirrors and go out to the field in order to encourage their husbands to have more children. That's what they would do. So these mirrors were used by women to promote healthy, moral, sacred marriages, because they beautified themselves in order to go and attract their husbands. So we take water from that exact mirror, from the kior made out of these mirrors, and we show the woman that you're acting in the opposite manner of your ancestors. Your ancestors were given such applause, and they were praised for promoting these marriages, and you are destroying marriages. So they take water from the kior. Water itself, you know, the Torah, the Bar Benel points out that Torah is compared to water. We find that throughout the Talmud. Torah is compared to water. Water brings life. Torah brings life. Water sinks down to the lowest points. Torah fits with those who are humble, the rabbis say. So she violated the Torah, so she drinks water. This is what we're showing, that you violated the Torah. You're going to drink this water. Is going to, rather than promote your life, it's going to kill you if you're guilty. We take the dirt of the temple, and we add it to her mixture. So the dirt from the temple represents the sanctity of the temple itself. It represents the statement of Abraham, of humility, that I'm Afar of Afar, I'm merely dust and ashes. And she did not act in a humble way. And also it reminds us that Bar Benel says that there's a provision in the Torah of bringing an offering which came as payment to a prostitute. It's interesting halacha. The Torah says that if a woman is a prostitute and she receives as her payment a cow or a sheep, that's forbidden to bring to the temple as an offering. I mean, even let's say she wants to repent for her behavior. So if I'm going to take this, it won't be accepted. You can't bring that in the temple as an offering. Because it shows that kind of behavior is something which is, you know, taboo in the temple. It cannot combine with the temple. So we show her, I'm taking the dust of the temple, and the temple itself repels this behavior, and you exhibit this behavior. We put it into an earthenware vessel, and earthenware is considered, as opposed to, you know, glass or metal, is a cheaper type of vessel. It's very simple. And it's also something that if you break pottery, you can't really fix it. If you break a metal or a glass vessel, technically you can melt it down and reform it. When it comes to pottery, once it's broken, you can't do much about it. And we're showing that what you've done is broken relationships, which you can't, there's no way to repair the relationships. We add into the water the bitter herbs, and it shows the bitterness of her acts. So again, every single detail used is supposed to be symbolic of something which she has done, either to remind her what she has done, to encourage her repentance, to encourage her confession, something of the other. One little deeper point is that the commentator you have in the Torah, the Kli Yakar, he writes a very fascinating point. He says that tradition tells us that we know that Adam, first man, was created from dust of the earth. So the rabbis teach us which dust was he created from. It was the dust from the Temple Mount. the dust of the Temple Mount. That's what the Talmud teaches us. So the Kli Yakar says that the source of the person, which is the dust the person was created from, the first human being, is what's used to check that person's actions. I mean, we usually understand it. It says that God formed Adam of the dust of the earth and then breathed into him a soul. So we should look at the physical elements of the person were from the dust, and then the spiritual elements are from that breath of God. So the woman who's acted based totally on her physical elements and not at all based on her spiritual elements, so that woman is tested out by that dust. I mean, the dust which created you can check how dust-like are you, how physical you become. And that dust is used in the process. So again, these are all details you have in the ceremony, but every single detail the Torah gives is supposed to be symbolic to us. So I want to just end with the Rambam's conclusion. He discusses the process of Sota. So the Rambam discusses, you know, how do we view this relationship, husband and wife? Meaning that it all began because the husband suspected his wife and warned her, don't seclude yourself with that man. That's how it all began. So the Rambam says, it's certainly a mitzvah for when a husband sees suspicious behavior that he should warn his wife. That's proper. As the Torah says, v'kineis ishto, he warns his wife. And those who warn their wives when they're suspect, so it's considered a pure and holy thing to do. But he says, you don't take this very lightly. You shouldn't do it, you know, as a joke. You know, you shouldn't do it out of lightheadedness. You shouldn't do it when you're angry with her. You shouldn't do it to threaten her or to make her scared. You do it when there's a genuine concern. I mean, a man could take this out of control. And he can start, you know, warning his wife about every single human being on earth. You know, I suspect you about everybody. And you can't squish out any man who exists. This is, you have to do it, you know, you have to be careful with this. And he says, somebody warns his wife in an inappropriate way, so it's still considered a valid warning, but it was inappropriate to do. And he says, a person should not jump at the first chance to threaten his wife and warn her in this way. You have to do it in a way which is pleasant. You know, don't bring in the witnesses the first time around. Do it with purity. Try to guide her in the right path. Meaning that, you know, we're trying to promote healthy marriages. We're not trying to promote marriages with tension and with spite, one or another. So every single time a man has this doubt, maybe my wife's doing something a little bit, you know, going a little too far with another gentleman, and he starts, you know, giving it to her and yelling at her, I'm bringing the witnesses, and then, you know, I'm going to take you to the Beis HaMikdash, and all these terrible things. So basically at that point, you've destroyed your marriage. I mean, I can't imagine a marriage can go on much after that. So the Rambam says, you know, when it's called for, it's appropriate. He says, even when you suspect her, first, you know, take her aside privately. Don't make an official warning as the Torah prescribes. Talk to her gently. You could discuss how much, you know, you respect her and you love her, etc. And try to just, you know, bring out the best in her rather than threaten her or scare her. And this will all, you know, remove her desire to spend time with other men, and it will guide her on the right path. And he says, on the other hand, if somebody just lets his wife or family just go about and do any behavior which is inappropriate, so that person is responsible. So on the other hand, I'm not talking about wives. In general, if we have people in our midst who we couldn't influence in the proper way, and we just let them go about and do whatever behavior they're doing, and we don't say anything, we don't attempt to bring them back to the right path, so we are held responsible for that. And he says that person is considered a sinner. So you don't want to take these things too far. On the other hand, you have a way to stop anybody, not just your wife or your husband, but anybody from inappropriate behavior, is our responsibility to try to put them back on the right path. There's a lot of ways about how to do that. You know, it's not so easy. You have to use your own personal sensitivities, and you have to use your mind to figure out the right way to go about, you know, trying to bring someone back to the right path. But the Rambam says that, on one hand, you know, don't take advantage of this process. If you do suspect somebody of something wrong, don't immediately call the witnesses and warn them and yell at them and threaten them. Rather, try to speak to them softly and gently with love and with purity. On the other hand, if you let things get out of control and you don't care what happens with your wife and kids or your household, so then you're somebody who is responsible for their behaviors because you haven't stepped in to stop it. So you have to have that balance. But that's how the Rambam concludes discussion of Sota, that even though it's important to make sure that you do, if you have suspicions, you have to address them, make sure you do it in a smart way that you're not going to immediately bring out your wife's anger and destroy your marriage in an instant. That's the Rambam's conclusion over here. Any questions? So that's the process of Sota.